Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Andreas Kluski. Andreas is the president and chief executive officer of AVS, a Fortune 500 global power company with revenues exceeding $10 billion annually. As president and CEO, Andreas has led the company through dramatic transformation by focusing on simplification, risk improvement, and innovation. Specifically, he led the company through a $5 billion divestiture program, has overseen the largest construction program in the company's history, and has helped the company become a world leader in implementing new clean technologies. Prior to being elevated to the CEO role, Andreas was the chief operating officer of the company. In this interview, Andreas discusses how AES is transitioning into cleaner energy. While the company's coal technology was among the best in the world, AES realized that was not a sustainable driver of growth. Under Andreas' leadership, the company has reduced its generation capacity from 60% coal to 30%. It has become a big builder of renewables, and it is looking to reduce its carbon footprint by 50% by 2020. We also discuss the advantages Andreas has enjoyed by being from a multicultural family, AES's work in China and India, the value Andreas gained from his education, and a variety of other topics.
Well, Andreas Kluski, welcome to Technovation. It's great to speak with you today.
Good morning, Peter. Great to be here.
Excellent. Well, Andreas, I thought we would begin with your role. You were the chief executive officer of AES and have been since 2011. And you were COO 5 years prior to that. You were a leader in multiple geographies around the world in energy with the subsidiaries of this organization as well prior to your COO post. And I know during your tenure as CEO, you've noted that areas of focus have been simplification, risk improvement, and innovation. And I thought we might take a little time and hit on each of the three and some of the activities you've undertaken in each.
Well, first I'd say when I came in 2011, AES was in almost 30 countries and had development activities in several more. So it was really widespread around the globe. So one of the things we decided was that we were really going to focus on less markets, but focus more intensively on them. We had to have really a critical presence, a critical mass in those countries. So today we're really in 12 countries as AES, as an operator. But at the same time, we're doing many more things in those countries in terms of we are now today one of the five largest renewable developers in the world outside China. And we're also leaders in several technologies. So it's really, let's focus geographically, but also extend our footprint in those countries, our position. So that was an important development, I'd say. This hand in hand with that was really to improve our credit rating and to improve our risk profile. So what we did was really tackle risk across the board, because there are many aspects to risk. It's not just the geographies, but it's also who your off-takers, type of technology you have, commodity exposures, because we are mostly a big generator. In other words, we're known as an independent power producer. So therefore, you know, you may be exposed to technological changes, you may be exposed to commodity changes. So one of the things that we did really was to make sure that where we couldn't hedge it financially was to actually bring in a technology that decreased that risk. So for example, in Panama, we had almost 800 megawatts of hydro. But we were very dependent on the weather. So our business is contracted generation. So we had to supply energy at $80 a megawatt hour to our clients. And in years of drought, we'd have to go out and buy in the market the shortfall in our production because there wasn't enough water. So, for example, in 2014, there was a severe drought in Panama. We lost $100 million because we were buying energy at $300 a megawatt hour to supply a contract at $80. So what we did first was float in a barge, and that produced energy, thermal energy. But that is relatively expensive, relatively small. So what we did was build a LNG regasification terminal and storage facility in Panama and an efficient combined cycle plant. This year, we have as bad a drought as we had in 2014, but really our losses are going to be marginal because the price of energy is pretty much capped at $120 a megawatt hour. So this is not only good for us, it's very good for Panama. So the U.S. is going to be a big producer of natural gas and has sufficient liquefaction facilities so that for this area of the world, it's really helped these countries. So Dominican Republic, we had done that in the past. So we calculate that by us bringing in cheap U.S.-based LNG to Dominican Republic, the country saves about $500 million most years in its import bill. And it's a much more stable price than oil prices. So it allows you to develop industries like tourism, services. So it's really a win-win. So this has been very exciting, bringing these new technologies. We also paid down about half of our debt. So it's $3 billion in debt that we have paid off. And again, we've also changed how we contract to make sure that we, for example, where we have hydros, we have reduced our level of contracting. So when there's a drought, we have to buy less in the spot market. So, you know, bringing in gas, bringing in new, better, more efficient technologies where we can hedge, getting out of countries that are higher risk, paying down debt. The other thing is the structure of the debt. So today, 95% of our debt at the subsidiaries is in the currency of that business. So, for example, in Brazil, if there's a devaluation, we'll make less profits, but we won't have a liquidity event because basically our debt's in reais as well. So these balance themselves off. So, you know, today, you know, we are on the path to become investment grade for the first time in the company's history. So I'm very proud. We're one notch below investment grade. We're working very hard to get there. So it was this reduction in the geographical footprint. It was the hedging. It was actually having real hedges, bringing in new technologies. And again, some can be very interesting. In Brazil, for example, we have hydros. So we've built and are building more wind in Brazil. And actually, when the wind blows a lot, it's not raining and vice versa. So it's a natural hedge. So, and I'd say the other thing is we've really cut a lot of costs. We think on an ongoing basis from the beginning to today, you know, we're saving close to $500 million a year in costs. And this has been done by centralizing certain operationals. And this is, you know, of course, technology played a key role. So we handle, for example, all of Brazil from one operating center, wind and, you know, almost 3,000 megawatts of hydro in different locations from one center. So we've centralized that. We've brought in technologies. And this is allowing us to save these money. So all put together, the company is in a good path. So in terms of innovation, in my some of my prior career, I was in telecom. So I witnessed how telecom companies went from companies that were quite, let's say, used to be called the plain old telephone pots, where there wasn't a lot of innovation. And you made your money really from long-distance phone calls. And, you know, you had to basically, you know, take very much care of the local copper wires, into a business where long-distance phone calls became free, mobility expanded dramatically. You created internet backbones. But it's interesting, through these transformation, those companies which were quick actually are making more money today than before. Mm-hmm. And it's a totally different business model. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of them, you know, are getting into providing content, but that's a different, I wasn't part of that phase. But so I lived that and saw how this change occurred. So I felt the same way here that this was an industry that was ripe for change. So I used to say that if you brought Tesla back to life, he would have in the year 2000 recognized today's electricity grid.
Yeah.
If you brought Alexander Graham Bell, he wouldn't have any idea about a fiber optic network. So, you know, that tells you a little bit the rate of change. Now, we're having very rapid change. And I think that those companies that will succeed like they did in telecom are those who are leading that change. So what we've done is, you know, first in the area of energy storage. This really was the holy grail for renewables, because the problem with renewables is that they're intermittent. And this really, I don't think, is discussed enough in I would say, some of the mass media, because people say, well, town X is 100% renewables. Well, it may buy 100% renewables, but it's importing non-renewables at some point in the time, because the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. So what we saw was the opportunity with lithium-ion batteries to combine them with renewables and really extend the period of time that you can dispatch renewables. The other thing is that renewables, the quality of the energy is more intermittent, because you get, you know, clouds pass. And so the fact is that by putting a battery between the renewable and the grid, the quality of the electricity you provide is actually the best. You know, it's perfect, because you're controlling the frequency, you're controlling the voltage. So we started doing this more than 10 years ago, and really were the leader. We had some of the first large-scale applications of this. As the price of batteries has come down, we've seen all sorts of new opportunities open up, because nowadays you're talking about five-hour batteries. Now, five-hour batteries, that's 5 hours at 100% discharge, you know, full blast. Well, you can dispatch them at 50%. That gives you a 10-hour battery. At, you know, 30%, you know, then you start getting almost. So we've done the world's first 24/7 renewables, truly 24/7 renewables, on the island of Kauai, with the Kauai Island Utility Cooperative, KIUC, where you really have solar plus batteries, and you're dispatching solar energy all day and all night, because you have that enough sufficient batteries. So, you know, today we are in 20 countries. We have 1,000 megawatts of energy storage. We're growing very rapidly. And for example, there's a case of a partnership to take advantage of this. We realized about a little over 2 years ago that we were ahead of everybody else on this technology. But we are not an equipment provider. And we also realized that as soon as this technology became, say, more known, economies of scale were going to be key. So we teamed up with Siemens. Siemens is in 160 countries. It's over a 100-year firm. It's really one of the premier electric technology companies. So we had the, patents, intellectual property rights. We had the design. We had the experience. And they brought, you know, Siemens's global reach. So that's one of the things that's really helped establish this as the global leader in this. Mm-hmm.
This is fluency, right?
Fluence.
Yes.
And
fluence,
so,
excuse me.
Fluence.
Yes.
And so what I see, this is an area that's going to really take off, because, you know, it's interesting. You have, well, yes, it's more renewable, so it's cleaner, but it's also a killer app. Mm. So the fact is that, you know, depending on where you are, but in places where you have a very good solar irradiation, it's cheaper than a peaking plant. So a peaking plant is a gas plant that you turn on when you need it, you know, like peak hours of the day. So most peaking plants are online 10% of the time. And they can do other things like control frequency and voltage. If you put an energy storage with lithium-ion batteries on it, you will be online 99.9% of the time. And where you have a lot of solar penetration, like say like Los Angeles, or Hawaii, the price of energy when you have the peak solar is zero. So actually, you can store up energy at zero cost and inject it into the grid right at the peak hours. So it's actually a killer app versus gas speakers.
Yeah, interesting.
For the most part. So we think that's really going to take off around the world in island situations, where, you know, it's much more difficult to have, say, hydros as backup or big gas plants. So I feel very confident that this is, you know, the future, and I'm very happy that we're the leader in this technology. The other side that we've worked very hard on, and this is more recently, I'd say the last 2-3 years that we really started focusing on digital. And this started as we were discussing that we invited John Chambers to come and talk at our, we have an annual kickoff meeting. And he was a spectacular speaker, very dynamic. But one of the things he mentioned is that the future of companies depends on their digital strategy. And we really took that to heart. And we, you know, work very hard on a digital strategy and hiring the right people who had digital experience. Now, there are multiple levels to this. So the simplest one is operational. So you predictive maintenance, understanding, but then you get into like predicting weather or demand. So there's some AI component. Mm-hmm. But there's a simple component. It's just, you know, back office operations. So there's less manual entries, you know, of data. But having more data at your fingertips, being able to manage, for example, all your renewables in the U.S. from one location. But then you have really this sort of predictive element that helps you satisfy customers' needs better. And that's really where we got in. First, we bought a company called Simple Energy, which was the largest energy efficiency marketplace in the U.S. So basically, you would go there to buy your Nest, and the advantage is that it would automatically give you the subsidies that you'd be receiving and automatically credit you the utility. So it basically worked through the U.S. utilities. There was another company called Tendril that had more sort of customer-based behavioral-type technologies. So we combined the two. We merged the two. And that has access to 100 million customers in the U.S., and it's clearly the leader in, I'd say, sort of energy efficiency cloud-based services in our sector. So it's very exciting to have a leader in the digital space, a leader in the energy storage space. A lot of this would have been quite unthinkable 10 years ago. Yeah. So in the interim of this, one of the risks that we thought was really let's decrease our carbon footprint. So we've set out goals that we've beat. So when we started, we were probably 60% of our generation capacity was coal. It's 30 today.
Wow.
So we've decreased, you know, we've sold or shut down about 4,000 megawatts over the last couple of years. But it's also what we've built. We've become a big builder of renewables. So we're seeing this switch. One of the things that we're seeing very interesting is that, you know, if you want to have 24/7 electricity, which everybody does, you can do it through the batteries. But a lot of places, that means a big investment. And it's not always, in all locations, it's not the cheapest yet. So how do you combine it with the existing? So one of the things that we have done is combine it with existing thermal. So again, in some locations where we have a long-term contracted thermal asset, we've gone to our clients and said, we will replace a portion of that energy with renewables. Mm. So instead of having 24/7 thermal, you'll have maybe 12 hours of thermal, 7 days a week. But the rest of the time, you're going to buy renewables from us. And in many cases, it's cheaper than the variable cost of the fuel.
Wow.
To build a new renewable. Mm. So, you know, that is also decreasing our carbon footprint, because what really counts at the end is how many, your intensity by gigawatt hour, what you sell. So we have goals of reducing it, you know, by 50% from the original 2016 levels by 2022. Mm. And so we're well on that way. So we're tackling it many ways. We're building renewables. We're bringing in LNG, which has less of a carbon footprint than other fossil fuels. We're bringing in renewables. And in those cases where you have to have thermal, we're combining it with renewables to make it less energy intensive. Mm-hmm. So we're very happy about the path we've taken. We're sure that this is the future. You know, eventually, sometime in the future, I can see countries becoming 100% renewable, but with a lot of energy storage.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. There's so much that you covered there, and I one of the things that strikes me as remarkably complex in your business is, as you mentioned, the 20 countries that you do business in, for example, the very different the differences in terms of weather, the differences in terms of which renewables are going to be able to work well in which environments, and so on. And I wonder, what does that process look like in determining what the right mix is in different geographies, or even different subsets of different geographies?
Well, that's a great question. So first, you have the resources themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, Southern California has better solar resource than, say, Canada.
Yes, exactly. That's right.
On the other hand, you may have places like in the Midwest where you have great wind. Mm-hmm. So we really, what I do like about AES when we talk to our clients is that we don't go with one size fits all. You know, like we're not just a solar developer. So you need solar in, it's really, we look at what are your energy needs and what is the best combination. And we can do pretty much anything other than nuclear. We don't do nuclear. But other than that, we do everything. Mm-hmm. So it's really, what is the combination that best satisfies your needs? What are the things you're concerned about? Is it carbon footprint? Well, how do we provide you the best energy with the lowest possible carbon footprint at the best cost? So we work very much with our clients now. It's a partnership. See, in the old days, it was just a bid. You won the bid. You built the plant. You supplied the megawatt hours. Nowadays, it's much more, the client has more specific needs. So it's tailoring that solution to the needs. Part of it, again, is digital. For example, what is the best customer interface? What information do they want to have? So that's the very exciting future. Now, overlaid on that, you have what are the regulations in country? So, for example, energy storage, I'd say the biggest break on its development has been regulations. Regulations tend to be backward-looking, 20 years ago technology. They're seldom, you know, right at the edge of the new technology. So a lot of this was working with regulators in many locations so that they would accept energy storage and allow it onto the grid. And how do you get remunerated? Because part of it, it can do things that the old technology couldn't do. For example, energy storage not only can inject energy into the grid, it can withdraw. So take Hurricane Maria and Irma. They hit the Dominican Republic, they hit Puerto Rico. In the Dominican Republic, we had energy storage next to our plants. So when the hurricanes hit, those plants were able to operate and get back online much more efficiently because what typically happens, a power line goes down. So suddenly you have this turbine, you know, at high revs, producing a lot of energy, and there's no one to take it. So you have to shut down in an emergency mode. That causes a lot of problems. If you have energy storage, it can actually take up the load temporarily from that line. So you can shut down the plant in a very efficient way. So energy storage has shown itself to be very resilient and help grids be more resilient. So, but, you know, quite frankly, it's not accepted in all places. And some places, they can't remunerate for what you can do going positive, negative, what you can do for stabilizing the grid continuously. It's not remunerated yet. So there are different needs, different regulations, different customers. And what we try to do in almost all of our locations, we are very integrated with the local economy, local sector. So if you go to any of our facilities, 99% of the people will be local, including, you know, the executives. We often have partners, local partners from those countries, or we work with the local pension funds. What's very interesting, I think we are the most sort of locally integrated almost of any big U.S. company. We have local boards of directors with eminent people from that country. And where we aren't like publicly listed, we will have a advisory board, which acts like a board of directors, where we invite notable people, locals, to that board. So I think that's given us a very good feel for what's happening in these economies. You know, we don't feel like foreigners looking in.
Yes.
You know, we're getting the local views of us and of the economy.
Yeah. It's interesting. You reference customers, and one of the complexities of this business, as you mentioned, is that there are various customers. There are the people who are ultimately gaining the benefit of this energy, the citizens of a country or a state or a region, as the case may be. There are the partners that you have within these different geographies. Of course, you mentioned the governments as well and the regulatory sensitivity you have to have in a business like this. And I'm curious, and I guess part of the answer to the question that I was contemplating is, in fact, the whole process of being local, of having talent that is local, of a board that is local, that is more cognizant of the sensitivities of each geography that you're in. I wonder, are there other ways in which you manage, you know, and get the kind of voice of the customer at the various levels that the customers reside?
Well, that's a very good point. I think that, you know, what's interesting about AES, our origin is that of a scrappy entrepreneur. You know, we had a founder here in D.C., you know, it was Roger Sant. He worked with Dennis Bakke, and they really were one of the first sort of the independent power producers. So we come at this from a more sort of a competitive point of view. We weren't sort of the incumbent utility. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is good to have as part of our DNA. We don't take the customer for granted. We've got to win each customer. So I'd say that you really have to have that dialogue with the customers. I still think that there's room for development, and I think digital is going to be a big part of that, because it's really understanding what they need to know. How do they want this information accessed? Which I think is absolutely key. So I think Kauai is a great example of working with a local cooperative. And we jointly designed this 24/7 renewables answer. We couldn't have, it would have been difficult to engineer this and come say, okay, here's the answer. We had to engineer it as a result of best understanding what they need. So this industry is going to change. I mean, it's going to be much more of the value is going to be with the customer. Much more is of the value is going to be data-driven and solutions-driven, getting away from the value was at the generation plant, and you just had to sell megawatts efficiently. So now I think it's a more interesting business, and again, reminds me very much of the transformation telecom went through.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very interesting. You've mentioned appropriately the importance of digital and how that was how that hit home to you and some of the ways in which that's translated in the innovation that you've brought to bear. I'm curious, can you talk a bit about how you've thought about the kind of ecosystem that's necessary in order to bring that together? Of course, part of it is building that digital fluency within the organization and building different technologies and capabilities. You referenced AI, for instance, in helping sort out weather patterns as a way to determine how to invest where. But you also talked about JVs like the one with Siemens, for instance. I imagine perhaps there are other digital organizations that you've become involved with in order to expand your reach and innovation capabilities from a digital perspective as well.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that nowadays, really going it alone is very difficult for companies. It's very difficult because this digital transformation is really change management, to change people's mindsets. And it's hard to have the technical expertise in all the areas, right? So you really have to partner with people.
Yeah.
So we do have various technology partners that we're working with, and I think we'll develop much further. I think internally, it's really part of this change in the mindset, to realize that this is, you know, a little bit like it's going to make your job easier. Because there's a great fear that we're all going to be replaced by computers like HAL, you know, that's going to make all the decisions. It's a little bit, it's not. I don't see that in certainly the medium term, you know, that we're going to have any of that. It's really like you're going to have at your fingertips information that will allow you to make better decisions. So, you know, when we talk about AI, the way I look at it, very simply, AI is just it's basically a program which modifies itself based on results. That's all it does. It's continually improving itself. If you're forecasting the weather and it's wrong in one direction, it will make an adaptation. But that's very different from, again, you know, doing all the things that you do in your job. So, you know, certainly in our business, it's going to be that human computer interaction, that if you optimize it, it's best. Mm-hmm. So it's very important to make your employees feel comfortable with that and not see it as a threat, but actually as an aid. If we think about our own jobs, I mean, without the connectivity that I have today, my job would be very different. I would need a huge staff, because you're basically connected 24/7 with the whole world. Mm-hmm. And you can, you know, read memos, you can call people up, you can have even sort of visual interaction with them, but it makes it a lot easier. So, you know, it's hard for me even to imagine going back to the old days. You know, I was an early adopter of things like cell phones. It looked like a brick, and you know, you didn't have much coverage, right? And thinking about how I operated then, you know, today is like, wow, how did we get places before GPS, right? So it becomes part of your life, but there is a important change management aspect of it, getting companies to accept this and getting them to accept to know that, look, this digital company is better than you, mm-hmm. But you're better at knowing your customer. Let's work together. And the last I'd say is the importance of data, that we have an enormous amount of data. We own companies that are 100 years old, have 100 years of data that we really aren't using, you know, to the benefit of the customer and our benefit as well. So that's also going to be how are we going to mine this data to create more value.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. One of the things that you established really aggressive carbon reduction goals, mm-hmm. which you referenced before, going from 60% on coal power to 30%, I believe mm-hmm. you said. And you became the first publicly traded company to issue a climate report in compliance right. with the Task Force on Climate-Related right. Financial Disclosures.
Right.
And it's interesting. I obviously, in some ways, being virtuous has become part of your strategy.
Right.
And documenting that virtue mm-hmm. and the changes that you're making that are going more towards renewables, right. a big part of our conversation and so on. Talk a bit about why you wanted to be first, why you, the advantages of being ahead on this. You know, there's certainly probably the cynics would say
yeah.
that there are advantages to being, you know, a latecomer sure. to that because you're then still taking advantage of all of the traditional means of doing
that's
things. But give your perspective.
First, I think that this is a very values-driven company. So the founders really, you know, established like five values. And it was very interesting on their first public offering. It actually listed it as a risk, saying we will first think about our values before anything else.
Wow.
You know, it was interesting. So the bankers made them put it as a risk. I don't see it that way. I see it actually helps avoid risks. So it's values driven. So that was easy. The company was in a sense a very values driven, and people wanted to do the right thing. What was difficult was realizing that what you were very good at is not the future. You know, so for example, we were, you know, in some coal technologies, the best in the world. And it's like, well, that's not going to take us into the future. How do you make that switch? So that was important. On some of the things, like it was the, it's the Task Force on Climate Disclosure, TCFD, that we were the first U.S. publicly listed energy company to come out with it. I think part of it is in view of that risk. So this really looks at, in light of climate change, how robust is your business? And I think that's part of this risk mitigation strategy, that you know, you've got to look at risk from many angles. It's very easy to simplify it and to say, well, it's geography or it's technology or commodities. It's all of them. So if there's going to be climate change, you know, how robust is your business to that climate change? So again, the basic entrepreneurial want to do good DNA of this company made that easier. What was harder is to say, we're not going to do what you're good at. We're going to do something completely different. Now, we are also the people who feel responsible for keeping the lights on. So sometimes our messaging is more difficult, because it's much easier to message if you're just a 100% renewables company. But you're not the folks who keep the lights on 24/7. So many times we have to combine the two technologies. So we realize that we're in a transition. The faster we can do that transition, the better. But we have a foot in both worlds. You know, and so from a messaging, it's more complicated. But honestly, we think we're the people who are doing the most good.
Yeah.
So, for example, we have, you know, retired 4,000 megawatts of coal, gotten it out of our fleet and replaced it with cleaner energy. But we're also running our thermal plants differently. Incorporate. So the truth is the impact that we've had on the global climate emissions is one of the biggest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, because it's you're reducing, you know, across the board. It's not just building some renewables. And, you know, the truth is, when you really get into the technical aspect, it's more complicated than a lot of the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
If you put in renewables and it forces you to cycle your thermal plants in an inefficient way, that can actually negate all the benefits of CO2 reduction.
Mm-hmm.
Because thermal plants are essentially like big tea kettles. You have to heat them up.
Mm-hmm.
So they are most efficient when they're run continuously. If you have to heat them up and turn them off, heat them up and turn them off, it's not efficient. So you'll actually use more fuel. So one of the things that we've developed is ways of keeping them running at very low levels. So the minute used to have to run them at 50% to be able to jack them up when you needed them. We're running some of our plants at 20% and then can jack them up. So, you know, we're reducing the total carbon footprint so it's a total global view of it. It's not just partial. Because it's, again, you can say, well, that's somebody else's problem. Let them deal with it. No, we're dealing with the entire picture, and we want to provide countries and consumers what they really can afford in the most environmentally friendly way possible.
Yeah. How do you see the evolution of places like China and India? These are economies that are, in some ways, kind of going through an industrial revolution akin to like the UK in the 1800s, yes. And they're bearing the environmental consequences. As if you go to Beijing or Shanghai or Delhi or Bombay, yeah. on the wrong day, on a sunny day, you won't see the sun. And I'm curious, how do you see the evolution of countries like that in their own kind of progress towards a mentality like you've described?
Well, it's very interesting. Well, China is really, you know, today the biggest builder of renewables in the world.
Yeah.
And they've subsidized effectively. You know, I really do think they've overbuilt their solar panel industry and been a big factor in driving down the cost of solar panels. So in that sense, they've done a lot. Now, in the case of India, it's very interesting because India is, you know, just really starting to increase its electric consumption per capita, 1.6 billion people. So their middle class is bigger than the entire U.S. population. So that's really where the future of global warming will be determined. So one of the things that we've done, we actually set up a 10-megawatt demonstration of energy storage in Delhi. The first of its kind in India, to show that how this works, what it can do. So this will allow them to have more renewables and build less coal plants in India. And so we think that that's a major needle mover. So we're seeing what we can do to get more energy storage into India, you know, localize it, because Prime Minister Modi has set up some very ambitious goals for renewables. And they are achieving them. But the problem is, it has to be effective. So the grid is very poor. So you can build the renewables, but if you don't have that 24/7 capacity, you're going to build the coal plants anyway. So that's the biggest contribution I think we're making anywhere. And it's attracted a tremendous amount of attention. You know, one of the other things that we're doing is that we're building the world's first virtual reservoir. You know, it's very difficult to get hydro dams permitted nowadays. You have to move people, you have to cut down trees in most cases. Well, we have a big run-of-the-river project in Chile. So nobody had to move, no trees were cut down. But the fact is, it generates electricity when the water runs. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you want to inject it when there are peaks, you know, and you want to save some of that energy. So what we're doing is putting energy storage. So instead of building a physical dam, you're just using the batteries. Now, this idea in the past, what people had done is use pump storage, where you'd run the water down, then pump it back up into the reservoir. But the fact is, electrons are a lot more efficient than molecules. So, you know, just the physics is such that it makes a whole lot of sense. So there's a lot of interest in that in India, because, again, land is very scarce, a lot of people. But you could generate carbon-free energy from the rivers to make it economically viable, you need this reservoir, so a virtual reservoir. So there are a lot of innovative ways that we're looking at to help the world, you know, achieve that desired future.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Andres, one of the things that's striking about you, you speak accentless English despite being a Venezuelan native. Have a PhD in economics here in the U.S. You have run businesses in multiple countries. You are in a business, clearly, as we've been describing, where being a citizen of the world is actually very useful. You understand different cultures. You have a greater level of sensitivity, I would imagine, than somebody who's only lived in one country, for example, and perhaps hasn't traveled as widely as you have. Can you talk a bit about kind of some of those advantages of having sort of lived life in so many different places, and as a result, perhaps have a different kind of awareness or empathy as you do business in different places?
Well, it's interesting. In my home, there were like five languages spoken. You know, wow. My father came from Europe, immigrated to Venezuela.
Yeah.
And actually, on my mother's side, grandparents immigrated from the States to Venezuela during the Great Depression.
Oh, yeah.
So I grew up in a multi-cultural household.
Yeah.
So I think it's an advantage because nowadays these problems are global. And so, for example, you know, not only solving these problems are global, but your supply chains. So, for example, where are most of the lithium-ion batteries made? Well, it's Japan, Korea, China. You're going to have to be dealing, you know, Siemens is a German company. So I think it's an advantage to be able to see that. Even when you're in your sort of home field, it gives you a different perspective than if you were just coming from that one place. Mm-hmm. So I think that the we need more cooperation. I know there's great, very nationalistic movements in different parts of the world. You're seeing it, you know, it's many places. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. I think that what is important is that all sectors of the population must feel included. Because part of that nationalistic movement in many places, I think, is because there's a sector of the population that maybe felt not participating in the progress and the advantages. So, you know, I think that that's incumbent upon, you know, not only politicians, but the corporate sector to try to include as many people as possible in the changes, which are making the world a better place.
Yeah, very interesting. Lastly, I referenced the fact that you are a PhD in economics. And, you know, in a day and age, perhaps less so in your industry, but I have an opportunity to meet with a lot of executives, especially on the West Coast, who are, you know, dropped out of college, did so, you know, at a very young age. And you know, you have like the Peter Thiels of the world who are paying people to do so with
right.
the hypothesis that the experience of starting a company or working at a startup is actually greater than education. And I oftentimes find it very interesting to get the counterpoint
sure.
of somebody who actually delved so deeply into a topic
right.
as to become a PhD in it. In your case, economics, you mentioned an yeah. emphasis on microeconomics. I have to imagine it's something that serves you quite well in your current
yeah.
role.
Well, I guess, you know, if you're somebody like me, I guess we needed to be trained for longer. Maybe
yeah.
some people are smarter and don't have to go to school. But I really think of education, it's you know, it's not like getting a hammer. It's part of you is developing yourself as a person.
Hmm.
So I think, you know, especially in the U.S. where you don't have that sort of specialization right away, it's a very good follow-on. You know, I think a liberal arts degree is great because it teaches you how to write. You know, economics taught me how to think about things in an organized fashion. It introduced me to mathematics. So I very much enjoyed that. I think that, you know, there are aspects of academia, as we talked, where you know everything about nothing. You could become very narrow, you know. So keeping that broad perspective, I think, is very important. I think really it's a question whether you do formal education or informal.
Hmm.
So the fact is, in today's changing world, you have to educate yourself till your last day or you become irrelevant. So it's just a question, do you like a formal education or are you going to be doing it on your own? And then different people work differently. I do think that a lot of our problems are very complex. And just the discussion we've had, they're not sort of simple one-liners. You know, it's a little bit, how do you integrate technologies? How do you really lower your carbon footprint? How do you improve the customer experience? It's not simple one-liners. So the part of it, I do think that we need to make sure that this sort of technical knowledge, we do have spokespeople who can make it understandable to people. Because otherwise, I think we're going to fall in simplistic solutions, which may not work. You know, the one-liner may not work. You know, it may be more complex. We do need technically competent people. So, you know, if you want to drop out of college and become an entrepreneur and sort of self-taught programmer, I understand that. But, you know, for example, if you're going to be operated on, you really want somebody who's a specialist in his field, right? And everybody's opinion is not equally technically sound, you know. I'm not saying one opinion is more value, but there is value to knowing what you're talking about. And, you know, economists have a reputation that they make forecasts to make astrologers look good. But the truth is there is science to
yes.
this. And, you know, what is happening, though, is that with, for example, cryptocurrencies, you know, that's changing, you know, some of the technical aspects, for example, monetary policy. So we need technically competent people who understand that. You know, you don't want a central bank where they don't understand blockchain and you know, cryptocurrencies. You know, how are those going to affect the economy? And the economy is reacting in different ways. But basically what I feel is that the economics gave me a methodology. And I never was very dogmatic. It was sort of eclectic in my beliefs of different theories. And if the data or the circumstances change, you know, I'll change my view, you know, and use a different model. So you're always testing that. But I'm a big believer, at least for me, it was very useful. And I needed that formal training to have a more disciplined train of thought. So I'm perhaps a recovering economist. But I do find it, and again, especially when you're dealing today with the sort of fluctuations in currencies and economies and trade rules, it's really been, for me personally, invaluable. It's helped me very much.
Well, Andres Gluski, thank you so much for taking time on Technovation today. It's been wonderful to get your perspectives on the evolution of AES, also where it's going, and the great innovation that you've brought to bear.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me next week when my guest will be Tom Bogan, the Executive Vice President of the Planning Business Unit at Workday and the former Chief Executive Officer of Adaptive Insights.